London, a city of commoners and kings. And at its heart, a museum with secrets dark and strange. Tales of espionage, pickled creatures in hidden spaces, a cursed gemstone.
I won't touch it.
And Britain's barbaric beginnings. Secrets hidden in plain sight inside the Natural History Museum. The Natural History Museum in London, England. It's a cathedral of nature, housing over 70 million specimens. During the day, thousands of visitors tour the galleries. But at night, when they've all gone home, this place seems to come alive with unforgettable stories about where we came from and where we're going. The galleries and dark passageways invite those who dare to venture behind the scenes. Take a closer look and discover secrets that are disturbing and sometimes brutal.
Well, we've got material from Gough's Cave in Cheddar Gorge in Somerset. And this is some of the material we dug up in the late 1980s from our excavations there in really just a small area of the cave. They're important because they represent people near the end of the last ice age in Britain. So they're the best sample we have of people from Britain at that time.
15,000 years ago, northwestern Europe was a desolate, uninhabitable polar desert. But somewhere around 13,000 BC, the Earth began to warm up rapidly, revealing a massive land bridge connecting Britain to continental Europe, a gateway for early nomadic man.
These people arrived really quite rapidly, probably following herds of animals migrating into Britain. We think that life was quite hard for these people. When we were excavating, we obviously found not just these human remains, the remains of a number of individuals. On this skull, which is an adult skull, we can see here cut marks running across this region here. There are also marks on the frontal bone, suggesting that perhaps the skin has been removed. On this jawbone, we've got a series of cut marks here where the jaw was disarticulated from the skull. So the material's been pretty extensively worked over by humans, and obviously there are many different reasons why that might have happened. It may have been an act of desperation, because of course we know cases today when there has been a crisis, people have been stranded somewhere, an aeroplane has crashed in the mountains, and people in the end are forced to eat other people.
British cannibals? Could this be true? If so, these bones offer evidence of what some of the very first Englishmen may have been eating for dinner. Each other. To investigate the mystery, we go to Cheddar Gorge, where paleontologists from the Natural History Museum discovered the puzzling bones.
Here we are in Gough's Cave, Cheddar in Somerset. This is now a commercial show cave. The floor level would once have been really quite high. This is the site of our excavation. Essentially, it's an area that was protected by this rock. And the crack down the back and the pit behind are where all of our finds came from. We found very large numbers of broken human bones, all jumbled up with the remains of animals like horses and red deer. And we noticed quite early on that the horses and red deer had been butchered for food and thrown away. And the human remains appear to have been treated in exactly the same way. Many of the bones that have been found here, both human bones and animal bones, have cut marks on them. And they're cut marks made by sharp flint. The animal remains were presumably being butchered so that people could eat them. And our supposition is that, therefore, they were eating the humans as well. People have suggested very complex ritual explanations. Archaeologists use the word ritual when they don't know what's going on.
For more than 20 years, these bones have been locked away in a back room of the museum's paleontology department, the source of the curious cut marks left unknown. But recent advances in three-dimensional imaging may provide Dr. Sylvia Bello the clues she needs to solve this ancient mystery.
Now the image is being scanned three-dimensionally, and you can notice that this series of cut marks is being reproduced by the scan image. We can turn our image and have a proper look of the cut marks according which angle we prefer. This is a clear cut mark. Here there is another one, which is much shallower. These specific marks tell me, well, first of all, is a series of marks, one next to the other. So the movement, it was a constant sort of filleting, in this case, of the mandible. The angle, in this case, is quite acute, which means that it was not a cutting angle, but it was more of a deflecting angle in this sense. The next step would be actually to see if some tool like this one can actually produce cut marks similar to the one we have here.
The next step is a trip to the town of Cheddar, where butcher Jim Baker will cut up a pig using replicas of sharpened stones or flints found at Goff's Cave. Sylvia wants to see how close the cut marks come to the cuts found on the fossilized human bones.
These are the sort of tool that were probably found in Goff's Cave.
Well, I'm going to start with this one, because this looks like...
very sharp. Are you actually using more strength in this case?
Really, at the moment. You can feel that you're right on top of the bone, and it's a scraping motion on the bone, so... Whether we'll get the cartilage out.
Seems the cutting is not really a problem.
Through the meat, it's not a problem at all, no. Very lots of sharp little cutting motions. Rather than with a knife, it's a much more sweeping
one single
action, yeah. You can hear it on the bone,
on
can't
the
you?
Bone.
Yeah.
It's coming certainly gently.
It's coming in small pieces, but and again you see there's that.
Oh yes, I can see the
yeah, you can
the
see
head
the top
of the
yeah, top of the head of the femur.
I was surprised if there are no traces on the bone at the end.
There you go. We've got one.
First one.
That surprised me, how easy it was, actually. Look at that.
Wow.
There we go.
Yeah. Just curious to see if there are any cuts left.
There's definitely cut marks down through there.
Yeah. So it would be very interesting just to see if is it exactly a reproduction of what we have on fossil,
yeah.
Which we can prove that they were using the same technique and possibly the same tool that we have here.
The pig bones from the butcher shop are cleaned, dried, and ready to go under Sylvia's microscope.
This is quite interesting. Because the location of the cut marks in here
yeah.
are exactly the same. So this is the one that has been butchered by the butcher.
Yeah.
And there is all this series of cut marks almost perpendicular.
Yeah.
And you can see exactly the same orientation, the same location on the fossil of Goff's Cave. But also you can see all the internal
yeah.
creation,
yeah.
which is the indication that
is fabulous.
Produced by a stone tool.
Yeah.
This one. And see the same characteristic, the forking at the end, the microstriation over there and over here. So they are very similar. And the fact that it becomes one single cut, and here it also becomes one single cut.
Clearly, the human bones found at Cheddar Gorge were cut up in the same way as the animal bones. And that leads Sylvia to a deliciously creepy conclusion.
If we're looking at animal remains...
there will be no doubt.
It'd be butchering.
For human, we can't be 100% sure it was cannibalism. Okay. But with this evidence, I am 99% sure.
It's a startling glimpse into Britain's dark past, leaving little doubt some of the first Englishmen were indeed eating each other. The Natural History Museum is home to some odd and disturbing artifacts. Of the 70 million specimens found here, perhaps none are more significant than those collected by famed naturalist Charles Darwin. His statue graces the main gallery, a tribute to the scientist who, in the mid-19th century, changed the world with his revolutionary theory of evolution. Today, only a fraction of Darwin's specimens are on display. The rest are hidden away in vast storage rooms like this one, where the museum's collections line more than 27 kilometers of shelving, including their vast spirit collection. This is the tank room. Here, thousands of specimens pickled in alcohol and formaldehyde stare from jars lining the walls. It's one of the biggest collections of its kind, and it keeps getting bigger. Carrying on the Darwin tradition is head curator Oliver Crimmon. For nearly 40 years, he's been adding unique specimens for future research.
This is why we call it the tank room. The larger specimens are here in tanks. We like our Victorian glass bottles, but for some of the bigger things, it's not practical to have a glass jar. This is Arapaima from the Amazon River. That's a big freshwater fish. It's good eating, I gather. So they're endangered in the wild. This one is a particular old favorite of mine. I used to watch it swimming around in the London Zoo Aquarium when I was younger. And years later, I found my old friend again in a museum tank when I got a job at the museum. So I've known this fish for some years. The collection goes back hundreds of years. That means that we have Captain Cook's specimens in the collection, Charles Darwin's specimens. You can think of it as a sort of Noah's Ark in the sense that specimens here that are no longer available in the wild. One of my favorites is a deep sea relative of the anglerfish. Their mouth is full of sharp fangs, and on the head there is the fantastic luminous organ. All you would see of it is the little luminous spots, probably like a little crowd of luminous shrimps. And coming to investigate that, you would be unaware of the mouth waiting below.
They may look like your worst nightmare, but to scientists around the world, there's endless potential for new discoveries in these pickled treasures.
This is the head of a basking shark. It's one of the giant sharks in the world, growing to over 30 feet long. It doesn't have much in the way of jaw teeth, so although much bigger than a great white, it's only got very small teeth. It's too big to go chasing around after big prey. So it's swimming along with its cavernous mouth open, mopping up little shrimps from the sea. The hydrodynamic trick that sharks have learned of having little teeth all over their skin has been very useful to a shark that's on the move all of its life.
All along a shark's skin are V-shaped teeth, or denticles. These denticles direct the flow of water away from the shark's skin, greatly reducing the forces of drag on its body.
Very important if you're a massive fish moving through water. Water's 800 times as dense as air, so it's hard work making a living moving forwards through water. And that's why these teeth are so important to sharks. Now, the Speedo company wanted to see if they could imitate that on an Olympic swimsuit.
In a sport where the difference between winning and losing is measured in hundredths of a second, Speedo needed innovative new technology to give their swimsuits the edge. By studying the denticles on the skin of the basking shark, they were able to develop the Fast Skin, a high-performance swimsuit that mimics the drag reduction abilities of the shark's skin. The fast skin first proved its worth at the Sydney Olympics in 2000, where swimmers wearing them won 83% of the medals. A triumph in the pool that may not have been possible without Oliver Crimmins' lovingly tended specimens.
This is a good example of the usefulness of specimens in the collection. You can't tell what they will reveal to us in the future. They are the subject matter of endless research. As time goes on, the collection becomes more valuable and more important.
The Natural History Museum in London is a mineralogist's dream, containing more than 300,000 samples of the Earth's riches. The most valuable of these are locked away in a vault, including a Martian meteorite, a rare crystallized gold nugget, and one of the largest uncut emeralds in the world. They are priceless and irreplaceable treasures. There's one gem in this collection, though, that's renowned not for its beauty, but rather for its dark side. The purple sapphire is feared. It was stolen during the Indian Mutiny of 1857 from the Temple of Indra. Misfortune, sorrow, misery, and even death is said to befall those who dare touch it. Many still believe the curse is real. But not mineralogist Alan Hart.
Well, this is the blasted amethyst, or cursed amethyst, as it's well known. It's a magnificent gemstone, beautiful amethyst crystal. It's a very large size. It's a very flat table. This is the flat area on the top, and that gives a window into the stone. But what's fantastic about this stone is that it had this great story with it.
The purple sapphire was given to the Natural History Museum in 1944 by scientist Edward Heron Allen. He was so afraid of the curse that he placed it in no fewer than 7 boxes, one inside the other. And with the stone, he enclosed something else, a written warning.
We do have the actual letter here. It says here, to whomsoever shall be the future possessor of this amethyst.
These lines are addressed in warning before he or she shall assume the responsibility of owning it. The stone is cursed and is stained with the blood and dishonor of everyone who has ever owned it. It was looted from the treasure of the temple of the god Indra at Cawnpore and brought to this country by Colonel W. Ferris of the Bengal Cavalry. From the day he possessed it, he was unfortunate and lost both his health and money. His son, who had it after his death, gave it to a friend who shortly afterwards committed suicide and left it back to him by will. Colonel Ferris's distraught son then gave the stone to the eccentric Heron Allen in 1890.
Heron Allen was a very interesting gentleman. You call him a polymath. He was into absolutely everything, like Persian literature, history of the violin. I think he was just interested in everything, and that would have involved the afterlife, the occult, supernatural, and so on and so forth. And I think this is one of the reasons why the purple sapphire he took so seriously, and the possible curse.
He belonged to a secret society of mystics, the Rosicrucians, and believed he could harness the forces of the afterworld to neutralize the curse of the purple sapphire. From the moment I had it, misfortunes attacked me, until I had it bound around with a double-headed snake, looped up with zodiacal plaques, and neutralized between Hayden's magic tower, and two amethyst scarabi of Prehistoric period, bought from Thebes.
So, interestingly, as a scientist and a mineralogist, I'm not sure what that means. So I find it quite interesting that the stone is mounted in the silver described such as Heron Allen has. And I'd like to know what that actually does mean. Is this designed to keep the curse into the stone?
Nehebka, the double-headed snake, is an Egyptian god of the underworld and fighter against evil. The Tau Cross, sacred in ancient Egypt and early Christianity, invokes the life-giving power of the sun. And so do the scarabs. More than 3,000 years old, these tiny carved stones are symbols of Khepri, the Egyptian sun god. Clearly, Heron Allen was desperate to contain the sapphire's curse. But still, it was not enough. In 1903, after another great misfortune fallen on me, I threw it in the Regent's Canal. 3 months afterwards, it was brought back to me by the Water Street dealer who had bought it from the dredger. Then I gave it back to a friend who was a singer at her earnest wish. The next time she tried to sing, her voice was dead and gone. I feel that it's exerting a baleful influence over my newborn daughter, and I am now packing it in 7 boxes with directions that it is not to see the light again until I have been dead by 30 years. Whoever shall open it shall first read the warning and then do so as he pleases with the jewel.
My advice for him is to cast it into the sea. I am forbidden by the Rosicrucian oath to do this, or I would have done it long ago. So rather than cast it into the sea, what we've done is cast it into our mineral collection. Do I believe in a curse? Well, obviously, no, I don't believe in a curse. Or else I won't be handling it like this.
But the legend of the curse still holds its power over many, including Heron Allen's family. Ivor Jones, grandson of the former owner, hasn't seen the purple sapphire in decades and isn't sure he wants to now.
Here we have the item itself.
Yes.
The cursed amethyst.
Blasted amethyst.
The blasted amethyst, yes. And there it is.
Yes. We don't want it back. My mother gave it to the museum.
Yes.
And it was an outright gift. Yep. No strings or anything.
Yeah.
And what you did with it was up to you. My personal opinion is that we ought to find out which Hindu god it was stolen from, and it ought to be returned.
Beautiful colour, lovely amethyst gemstone.
It's a lovely thing. It would make an absolutely marvellous brooch.
Yeah.
For a girl now.
If she would be willing to wear it, of course. So, Ivor, before we put this back into the vault on display in the museum, would you like to hold it for one last time?
I won't touch it.
Right, yes, yeah, sure.
And nor would any of my brothers or sisters. Call me superstitious, but I'd rather not.
Some stories from the Natural History Museum, like the curse of the purple sapphire, are sinister and mysterious. But others explode with violence, taking us back to the early days of the Second World War. With the fall of France in 1940, the Allies were driven out of continental Europe by the Nazis. But the beleaguered British fought back, forming a top-secret unit, the Special Operations Executive, the fabled SOE. Their mission? Set Europe ablaze with acts of sabotage behind enemy lines. The Natural History Museum became one of their bases. This was where spies and saboteurs were outfitted with weapons, explosives, and other lethal tools of their trade. Wartime spy Ian Fleming spent time here and later created the gadget-loving character Q for his James Bond novels.
The idea was if you were a field agent, you would be brought here to show what the SOE could supply you in terms of weapons and explosives. So basically it was sort of like a shop. There was a windmill here, a generator, and you would put the generator in a field and you could charge the batteries to your radio. We're now walking into the Marine Gallery. There was a diver standing here in diving gear, and he was the pilot of a small miniature submarine that was displayed here. And here was a workshop. It was from here that they used to make the molds of the plaster casts of the coal and the logs, and they were hollowed out, and you could hide things in them, and you would put them in your lorry, and if the Germans looked, it just looked like coal.
The camouflage unit was responsible for some of the most ingenious and effective explosive devices conceived during the Second World War. Few of these lethal gadgets remain, but there are blueprints and photographs, enabling Sidney Alford to reconstruct the past and discover how they worked.
I'm weighing out about 200 grams of plastic explosive called PE4. I have a certain available volume, space for the explosive. I'm going to put it inside the skin of a rat was surplus to the requirements of the pharmaceutical industry, I believe. I didn't have it killed for the purpose. I like rats. I'm replicating a particular type of what nowadays would be described as an improvised explosive device, a bomb, for the purpose of sabotage in German-occupied countries during the Second World War. It was to be used particularly by special operations executive. I'll just trim the cottons, lest a very observant furnaceman say, hey, that's been stitched up. I don't think if you were in charge of soaking a furnace, you'd notice that this chap has got insides that he wasn't born with. We've made here a representation of a boiler. The essential is that it has a furnace as part of it. It is quite substantial. It's made in steel. Here we have a plain detonator with safety fuse coming out of it. I have wrapped the safety fuse with PVC tape and with aluminium foil to protect it from the flames, because I don't want it to ignite prematurely. I want to get a safe distance away. And I do believe that that detonator is now inside the body of explosive. And the concept was that these will be dispersed here and there, wherever there was a boiler. These will be thrown in the piles of coal in those countries occupied by Germans. When the stoker comes along, he would not like the rat to be lying around his place of work, so he'd pick it up by its tail or on a shovel and throw it in the fire, and no doubt then add some more coal. Certainly did the job. I can understand why anyone who's done the experiment will be scared of rats lying around boiler houses.
These vintage improvised explosive devices caused havoc in Nazi-occupied Europe. Eventually, some of this SOE technology fell into the hands of the German resistance, who were plotting to assassinate Hitler.
For the attempted assassination of Hitler, they decided they would try to insinuate onto his aircraft some of these Type C bombs. And it contains the explosive, which was a mixture of TNT and tetryl. The purpose of this is to insert means of initiation, which in this case was intended to be a time pencil.
The time pencil is an acid-activated spring fuse. When the copper end is crimped, it breaks a vial of acid, which slowly dissolves a wire holding a high-tension spring. When the spring is released, it drives a firing pin into a detonator, setting off an explosion.
Now, somebody had the bright idea that if you take a pair of these, and I made some mock-ups for the purpose, and put them together, they have very approximately the same dimensions to a bottle of the French liqueur, Cointreau, which was no doubt quite a luxury in Germany during the war. I like it myself.
March 1943. After visiting the Eastern Front, Hitler prepares to fly back to Germany, and the conspirators make their move. The detonator is inserted, and the entire package is wrapped to look like two bottles of Cointreau. At the airfield, one of the conspirators presses the outside of the package, breaking the vial of acid. He hands it to one of Hitler's staff, telling him it's a gift. The bomb is set to explode in 30 minutes. That afternoon, Hitler's plane takes off.
Here we have a representation of the bomb and of historic interest. What I'm going to use is an equivalent amount of explosive. This is just cartridges of standard plastic explosive to British military P4. Given a little more time, I might have been able to arrange a suitable plane to blow up, but
we're using this van, which after all is well constructed and in steel, as a pretty good equivalent to an aeroplane. When you see the effect on the van, I don't think you'll quibble. I'm now going to put the detonator into the explosive. The original idea was that it would be placed in this, I'm sure, expensive and beautifully wrapped presentation box, more or less in the middle of the vehicle. Three, two, one. The effect was a bit more than I had expected, I must admit. There's a panel over there. Seems to have reduced it to its large sheet metal component. There's the top, which came off in a way which I actually predicted, I must say. It's inevitable that it would have blasted a hole where I put the charge. And imagine that that were an airplane. There will be the floor of the airplane, of the fuselage, flying through the air pretty well by itself. It could not conceivably remain aerodynamic. It is absolutely obvious that an airplane could not have survived it. The question arises, therefore, why didn't the bomb go off?
Less than 2 hours after takeoff, Hitler's plane arrives safely. Some historians believe that a faulty detonator cap or cold temperatures caused the bomb to malfunction. But Sidney Alford has a new theory about why the conspirator who packaged the bomb missed his big chance at changing history.
I rather suspect, but he forgot, I would guess, that that was a safety device and you had to remove it before the thing could work. He must have been in rather nervous condition when he was getting ready this bomb to prepare Hitler. The consequences of his being caught in the act would have been horrendous for him. If he had not made that mistake, what the implications on history would have been? Hitler dead in 1943. Think about that.
There are other objects housed in this grand museum that lead us to surprising stories from the past. Weaving our way into the back rooms, we find one of the most extensive collections of mammal skeletons in the world, including a few specimens that tell a dark story, one of violence, cruelty, and extinction.
These are two skulls that were excavated from the moat at the Tower of London back in 1937. They were actually examined by my predecessors who made the identification that these two specimens were actually lions. Some of the more distinctive areas on the skull which really tell you that these are lions, things like the huge nasal passages. And this huge arch actually is an aperture through which the enormous jaw muscle passes. And of course, in combination with those ferocious looking canines, we know that these things have got a heck of a bite. The two skulls were found to be Barbary lion. And for the Natural History Museum, of course, that was very, very exciting because up to that point, we didn't have any identified specimens of Barbary lion in the collection. This specimen, which looks like the more recent of the two, was in fact the oldest specimen. Now, the carbon date range that came back for this one was late 13th, early 14th century. They're the first two lion skulls to be discovered in England since the end of the last ice age.
But why were the bones of the Moroccan lions found at the Tower of London? There's a clue in other bones that were found with them in the moat.
But apart from the lions, we have these wonderful examples here of dog skulls found in the moat. So this one in particular is of great interest to us because you can actually see on the left-hand side a puncture wound to the cranium. What we assume has happened here is that this specimen, this dog, has been involved possibly in bear baiting and that this is a fatal canine puncture wound. It speaks volumes, I think, for what's going on in the tower.
Thank you. The Tower of London, where English kings sent traitors to die, was infamous for torture and execution. But there was another very different kind of cruelty that took place here.
This is the main western entrance to the Tower of London, and this is where the Royal Menagerie was from the 13th century right up until the 19th century. And here lots of exotic animals were kept, and we can see the drawbridge you would have crossed to come in. You would have had to walk through a tower which isn't there any longer. The gate was originally built as a defensive structure, as a barbican, but it was very quickly known as the Lion Tower because this is where the lions were kept. Lions were kept consistently at the Tower of London because they were part of the royal coat of arms. They were the living representation of the monarchy. And you can imagine approaching this amazing, very impressive, very threatening castle. You've got the lions roaring at you. It really is the royal presence, if you like. There would have been a huge range of animals in the menagerie. There was an African elephant, which was a gift from the King of France. The Hudson Bay Company give the Tower of London a grizzly bear. Initially, the animals are here really as status symbols. But by the 17th century, it's officially an area that's being used for lion baiting. They've got dogs and bears and different animal fighting, really, that people are betting on. The King, King James, is very keen on this and has a special platform constructed. So it's kind of like an auditorium and people can come and watch.
In the 1930s, hundreds of years after the Royal Menagerie had been closed, archaeologists made a startling discovery in the tower's moat.
What they found, which they weren't expecting, were these lion skulls and also dog skulls. But the lion skulls are extraordinary because they have been dated to the medieval period, and they're also, as I understand it, a breed of lion which is now extinct.
But this breed of lion may not be extinct after all, and the museum lion skulls could help prove it. Conservationist Dr. Simon Black believes the descendants of Barbary lions may still be alive and well, and living in zoos around the world.
Here we have the Moroccan royal lions, which is the animals descended from the royal palace collection of the King of Morocco. And he obtained these originally from the wild in North Africa. And what's particularly interesting about these animals is some of the differences you see compared to lions you might see in sub-Saharan Africa. So he's got a very, very pointed crown tip at the top of his head and a very straight line down to the tip of his nose, which gives this very regal sort of look. But one of the most noticeable features is this lovely mane that goes round his head, round his body, and down under his belly. And then if you look at his eyes, you've got very pale eyes. And this appears to be a characteristic of Barbary lions and seems to be consistently found in animals that are from the Moroccan King's collection. We believe that as they've been kept in captivity, it's offered us a chance maybe to rediscover Barbary lion, or lions at least have some of that ancestry in them. And this is where these guys come in.
The plan is ambitious. Take DNA samples from lions across the planet and compare them with the DNA of Moroccan royal lions.
And when we compare the Moroccan royal lion with a lion from southern Africa, we see that most of these pairs match up. But as we go through, we find areas such as here where there is a mismatch. And if we compare again with another set of lions, this one from Ethiopia, again, going across, a lot of commonality between all three lion populations. But then differences are starting to appear as we go across this small sequence. So far, with the few tools and data that we do have available, we are starting to find that there are tantalizing differences between the Moroccan royal lions and lions from other populations.
This suggests they are a separate species, not related to other lions. But the question remains, are they true descendants of the once majestic Barbary lion?
There's a pool of data there from the bones of those museum specimens that can tell us a little bit about this jigsaw of DNA, what it looks like in Barbary lions. And we can go back, check that DNA data, and then match it with the Moroccan royal lion and say, is there a good match? If these animals are shown to be authentic, then effectively you are resurrecting an animal that so far has been considered extinct and would be showing evidence that there's a subspecies of lion which we haven't been able to talk about for the best part of 100 years.
Research remains to be done. But these 700-year-old skulls have brought scientists one step closer to rediscovering a lost species and a dream of one day returning the Barbary lion to the wild. Walk around the corner and down the hall, and we find another mysterious specimen. This is one of the most rare skeletons in the world. The bones belong to a bird that hasn't been seen in more than 300 years. The dodo was obliterated with such speed that the example still resonates today. The expression, dead as a dodo, evokes the grim concept of total annihilation. And the bird entered history as one of Mother Nature's biggest losers, a weak, lazy, fat failure. But at the Natural History Museum, they believe the poor dodo has been getting a bum rap. To finally set the record straight, researchers at the museum are looking for answers deep within the dodo's centuries-old bones.
Well, this is a thin section. It's a slice through the thigh bone of the dodo, and it's been cut and ground down to about 30 to 50 thousandths of a millimetre thick. It's thin enough to let light go through it. This area here in yellow is an area of bone fibres that are running in a circular fashion around the diameter of the bone, and that is a characteristic of fast-growing bone. And this shows us that the dodo was able to grow from a chick to an adult without any interruptions in its growth. So this does tell us something about the ecology of Mauritius before humans arrived.
Mauritius is an isolated volcanic island in the Indian Ocean and was the home of the dodo. The bird's ancestors looked like large flying pigeons and migrated to this small island millions of years ago, finding plenty to eat and no predators. A dodo paradise. Dr. Julian Hume is a world expert on the dodo. For years, he's been trying to piece together what life was like for this elusive bird.
The myth that the dodo was an inadequate species, doomed to extinction, fat, vulnerable, is totally wrong. This bird was perfectly fine-tuned. It wasn't this slow, waddling thing that wandered around its island home. It was actually a very active species. It actually took the equivalent of a large mammal. So it became a cow, if you like, of the Mauritian forests. It would have eaten the fruits on the ground, and everything about the bird's ecology evolved to being on the ground. And that's a key thing in why the dodo became flightless. It's very expensive in terms of energy for a bird to fly. And nature always works in a conservative way. If you don't need those energy sources, get rid of them. The breast muscles, the muscles that produce flight, are attached here to a bone called the sternum, and this usually has a big keel on it of which those muscles are attached. Well, the dodo didn't need them, and so the keel has disappeared, and the muscles would have become very small. And as you can see from the wings just here, how small those wings are compared with the rest of the bird. Being perfectly adapted to its Mauritian home, there's a price to pay. If it was left alone, the dodos would still be happily walking around Mauritius right to this present day.
But in the 1600s, European settlers arrived and mistook the gentle spirit and fearlessness of the flightless bird for signs of stupidity. They dubbed it dodo, meaning crazy or fool in Portuguese. The label stuck. The Europeans also brought new animals to the island. Rats, dogs, and pigs attacked the dodos and their nests, feasting on the eggs.
The dodo had evolved in perfect harmony with its forest home for millions of years. Suddenly, It was faced with all this onslaught of introduced animals, and it could not cope. So after that first mention of dodos in 1599, just 80 years later, it was gone from this world. It was totally extinct. And what can we learn from that? Well, here we are as human beings on this planet, thinking we're above nature, and we are probably just as vulnerable in the long run if dramatic changes take place on this planet. And we may well indeed follow the way of the dodo if we're not careful.
Every skeleton, every specimen, every hidden space in the museum has a story to tell. We've explored a few. Many more remain, because the Natural History Museum is home to millions of treasures. Seeing behind the glass, taking a closer look, we can discover other extraordinary museum secrets.